Hey everybody, I'm your host Stephen Pulverant, and this is Hodinkee Radio. Our guests this week are two guys named Asher Rapkin and Gabe Riley, and they're the founders of a new kind of watch club based on the West Coast called Collective. It started as a Facebook group, but it's evolved into a whole lot more than that. They do meetups, and they even collaborate with watch brands. They brought their first watch by, we got to check it out, and we got to chat about kind of what it means to be a watch enthusiast today, and how these two childhood friends have taken their shared passion for watches to make something pretty special. But before that, I sit down with James and John to talk about an article that was published in the New York Times last week about the 10 watches that have shaped what's on your wrist today. We look at these 10 watches, all from the 1990s and newer, and kind of examine how each of them has had an impact on watch culture today. We also talk about the watches that didn't make the list that we might have included. And if you have suggestions, let us know. Visit Hodinkee.com, leave it in the comments, hit us up on Instagram. I think there's going to be a lot more to this conversation down the road. So without further ado, James, John, and myself talking about the 10 watches that changed what we wear today. This week's episode is presented by Grand Seiko. Stay tuned later in the show for a look at one of the four watches from the new Seasons collection, which is exclusive to the US. For more, visit GrandSeiko.com. Hey guys, what's going on?
Not too much. How you doing?
Pretty good. How about you, James?
Yeah, no complaints.
Yeah?
Happy to be at the office always.
Yeah, we got you here, what, this weekend, next week?
Yeah, I'm around.
All right, I think that means people are going to be here and hearing a lot from James while we got you here.
There you go.
So we're here to have a chat about an article that was published in the New York Times the other day. You know, the New York Times actually covers watches in a pretty regular way for a kind of like big major publication. They talk about watches a lot, and they have some great watch writers, one of whom is, I think, a friend of all three of ours, Victoria Gamelski, who wrote this article the other day, published on October 26th, and the article is called 10 Watches That Changed What's On Your Wrist. And this kind of made the rounds in our internal Slack, and I was getting emails and text messages about it from people, and thought it'd be fun for the three of us to kind of sit down, go through the article, and kind of weigh in ourselves.
Good idea.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, full disclosure, Jack, our fearless editor-in-chief, is quoted in the story. This guy, Evald, who used to write for us, is also quoted in the story. And basically everybody else we know in the watch industry is quoted in the story. Victoria did a pretty great job.
It was really, really well sourced.
Nicely researched. And like, I think like we could pick other watches, and I'm sure we'll get to that. Mm-hmm. She didn't really miss anything. Nothing like of strong note.
Yeah. I mean, I think she, in terms of like what you're looking for, or
it's a good list.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good list, but also kind of like from a design standpoint, the influences that are, you know, prevalent today are all accounted for in these 10 watches, I would say.
Yeah, so the kind of like the conceit of this, right, is that, I mean, the opening line is, what does contemporary design mean in an industry that perennially looks backward? And that's a good question to ask. I mean, watchmaking is a lot about heritage, a lot about yesterday. You know, we think of kind of like the golden era of watchmaking being the sort of like mid-20th century. And this article is not about that. So she said, you know, talking to people, she kept hearing about the Tank, the Speedmaster, the Daytona, the Royal Oak, the Nautilus, and like these things range from being from the, you know, 19 teens in the case of the Tank up through the 70s in the case of the Royal Oak and the Nautilus. But she wanted to know what was going on today. So the idea was to look at kind of the modern era of watchmaking, essentially the last quarter century, like post quartz crisis, like late 80s, early 90s up till today. And so I think what I want to do here is let's walk through the 10 watches. Let's just give our takes on these 10 watches. And then at the end, I want to get your opinions on if there's any watches that Victoria included that we don't think should be included, or additional watches that maybe could have taken the place of one of these. You guys game?
Absolutely.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, let's do it. Number one. Starting off, these are chronological, by the way. Number one in 1993 is the Audemars Piguet Royal Oak Offshore. It's a pretty good place to start.
Yeah.
What do you guys think about the Offshore?
I mean, I think it's a hugely influential watch. And I think it's interesting. You know, she makes the point that we will often point to Panerai as the watch that kicked off the larger watch trend that we saw really become quite a thing, not this decade, but in the decade prior. But it was in fact the AP's Royal Oak Offshore in 93 that was there first.
Yeah, so I mean, the Offshore was 42 millimeters wide and 15 millimeters thick in 1993.
Yeah.
Like, that's the era when, like, you know, Blancpain, who was kind of at the, like, forefront of the mechanical watch revival at that time, they're making, like, 35 millimeter minute repeaters, you know? Like, that is a very different thing.
Yeah, it was big and it was early. I mean, there were, of course, bigger Panerais earlier on, but the real revival of Panerai didn't come toward later in the 1990s.
Yeah.
I think that it's interesting to consider the idea that, especially with this list, and maybe we could find a couple others, but especially with this list in regards to watchmaking, so maybe we'll eventually get to what's the last watch on this list, and it's hard to class that in the same realm of watchmaking as the rest of these. Mm-hmm. But I think what's on here is a really interesting cross-section of what, and Stephen, you can probably correct my concept of postmodernism, but I think, especially if you talk about the Rue, the Royal Oak Offshore, one of the first truly postmodern watches.
I would agree. I would totally agree with that. That is good use of postmodernism, James.
Yeah, so the
concept, self-referential.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's
well,
what it is.
The concept that it has merit in its existence, not in its reference to other existences.
Yeah.
Which is that's an oversimplification of postmodernism, yeah, but it also is effective in keeping this conversation moving forward. I find that to be a fascinating decision and a really interesting watch to open this with, not only because of 1993, and a lot of the watches on this list come quite a bit later than that, but also at a time where, I mean, like there were a lot of brands doing things that they had done before or just trying to stay alive.
Yeah.
And this is a brand looking almost exclusively forward. They're holding on to a name, Royal Oak. They're holding on to a Genta case shape.
Yeah.
But really eschewing a lot of what Genta built into the Royal Oak in an attempt to make something modern and youthful, something that felt right in the 90s.
Yeah, and I mean, I happen to be lucky in that I know Emmanuel Gate, who's the designer who designed this watch, right?
Incredible.
And I've talked to him about, like, so what happens when you get this call and they say, like, we want you to do something inspired by Genta, but not Genta. Like, it's got to be its own thing, but it also has to be a Royal Oak. And he's said that it's a tough design problem just as a designer. Like, that is a difficult brief. But his own sort of like approach to watchmaking is really evident in this. You know, he grew up in a watchmaking family. His father was a freelance watch designer, worked for all the big brands. I probably can't name them for like legal reasons, but if you're thinking that name, almost certainly. And Emmanuel said that like the thing that frustrated him about watch design, you know, coming out of the 80s is that everything went safe again. And he hates that. Like he's one of those guys who like he wants to shake shit up and he wants to kind of like blow people's minds and make people think. And I think that's kind of like a perfect synopsis of what the Offshore was, is it was like, oh, you think you know what a luxury watch is? Like, fuck you. No, you don't. You know, like I know what a luxury watch can be and I'm going to show you that. And I think, you know, I think there's an argument that the Offshore is the first watch of the like modern era. Which is why I think it's such a great place to start this list.
For sure.
So a year later, we'll go to the next watch. A year later, 1994, we get a watch that is very, very different, which is the Longinzona Lange 1. Lange, obviously, a Longinzona started, kind of was reborn in 94. There's this famous press conference that's almost become, I mean, it is real, but it's become almost like apocrypha in the watch world, people talking about having been at that press conference and whatever. And they released four watches, the most famous, and I think at this point we can call it iconic, despite me sort of having a knee-jerk reaction against that word. We get the Lange 1. It's, again, unlike any other watch. I mean, there's nothing out there at the time, anything like the Lange 1.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say there's no watch out there with a big date that's better known.
Yeah, I think that's probably true.
I also think that it's interesting that you have the Royal Oak Offshore, which of course is referential to the Royal Oak and kind of speaks to Audemars Piguet surviving the quartz crisis and knowing that they have to do something to remain relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the, like in many ways, the antithesis to the same concept, but born of a similar era, just from a different part of the world. It's a different sort of thinking about luxury. It's a different sort of thinking about tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to respect tradition, but they didn't have something to look back on that strongly. they didn't have a Royal Oak in their pocket from the mid-70s. They had to go...
They had to do something
new. And I would say this is, especially on this list, this is one of the most traditional watches.
Yeah.
But as an idea, it's one of the flat-out youngest.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's traditional, but it's also new, which is a really, really hard thing to do, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
Very German.
One of my favorite things about this watch that does not get talked enough about is the way these elements are laid out. So, you know, people who know my taste will know I own almost exclusively time-only watches. Like, a date is about as complicated as I get personally. I happen to love the Lange one, and there's so much going on in this watch. You know, it's you have the hours and minutes in a large display. You have a sub-seconds. You have a large, like, you know, arced retrograde power reserve indicator, and you have the big date. There's also branding at the top. There's some text at the bottom, the Doppelfederhaus text. There's a button sticking off the side of the case. Like, there's a lot. But one of the reasons it works so well is that the way the elements are laid out is actually a golden spiral. And it's a real golden spiral. It's not like what Patek does with the ellipse, where they say it's inspired by the golden ratio, but like, it's not actually those proportions, which is a whole other thing for me to scream about a whole other time. But part of the visual harmony of this dial is that, like, it's actually rooted in, like, you know, millennia old concepts of, like, what works. And it does. Like, it does just work. I think. I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah, I'm no, wrong. It works. In my opinion as well, it works 100%.
Gorgeous. It's collectible. Yeah. Old, new, they all kind of stack up nicely against each other. There's some really special ones, which we have a post that went up earlier this week.
Oh yeah, we'll link up to that. To,
yeah, Ben's, which story. I highly recommend. Any time that Ben wants to write about the Lange one, that's definitely worth reading.
Yeah, I'm gonna read that, you know, every day.
One of my absolute favorite fine watches. I would absolutely aspire to own one day. I think their modernity is also reflected in how wearable they are. They're just the right size. Jeans and t-shirt, no problem. A suit, no problem. It's a clever thing. It's a beautiful thing, and of course it's really beautifully made.
Lange one with the t-shirt is such a boss move.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, oh, yeah, for God. Sure.
All right, let's go to watch number three. We're gonna jump a couple years ahead. 1998, the Viani Halter Antiqua. This is a watch that it's pretty polarizing. I'll admit, the first time I saw this, I was like, "What the hell am I looking at?" But I've kind of come around. What do you guys think? What are your kind of like knee jerk reactions to seeing this watch on this list?
I mean, to me, this watch, it's an iconic, independent watch for sure. And I see it as kind of, in some ways a precursor to the world we see today, which has many, many, independent watch brands and that are known well. You know, this is a watch that it looks nothing like a traditional watch, you know?
Yeah.
It is a totally original design. It's a totally creative thing. And I think you kind of flipped the idea of what a watch could look like on its head. And that was so important to, you know, fostering the kind of environment for independent watchmaking to move forward and to be what it is today. So, you know, for those reasons, I would say, yeah, it definitely deserves to be on this list.
Nice. How about you, James?
Yeah, I remember, and I'm blanking on what the publication is called, but I remember before there was a lot of like reference grade material easily to find on the internet. I used to go to Chapters, which is, you know, like an Indigo, a bookstore in Canada, and annually they would put out one of these big, it was like a catalog, basically. Do you guys remember these? It would have like almost every brand you could imagine. I'm sure the brands had to pay.
Oh yeah, like
to be
the wristwatch annuals.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Goodness sakes, how do you forget that?
So many watches were so well documented on the internet. You know, not just on our site but on others. Those annuals were like indispensable tools.
Agreed.
If you wanted to learn about watches,
and they had the prices.
They had
a little blurb about each one.
Exactly. You could see. You know, which movement was in each watch, and it was. Yeah, they still are fantastic things.
Fully agree. Wristwatch annual was rad, but I remember, and I think it wasn't the normal annual one that came out. It was a special one that had maybe more avant-garde watches or something else, because it also had a Zenith Defy, one of the really early, like the late 90s, early 2000s, the really wild ones, like a red case and like a weird open heart dial. You might remember the one I mean.
Yeah. The ladies... El Primero's often had those that kind of opening. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, that was from a different era of Zenith.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And a Zenith that doesn't exist now.
No,
certainly.
That was like the Tyrannotauf.
Exactly.
Zenith,
yeah. Yeah. And I remember getting that, and it had a piece on the Antiqua in it, and just being blown away by what I was looking at, and then to find out it used like a relatively conventional movement, and it was about having, you know, isolating the displays, and it just seemed so thoughtful and so left field at the same time. I mean, it had an impact on me now, or it had an impact on me then, and then I think I've only ever seen one in person. It's quite a bit smaller than I expected.
Yeah.
The displays are really tiny, especially the year display, and really, really cool. And even now, they no longer feel modern, but they didn't feel traditional when they came out either. It's kind of interesting.
Maybe the most steampunk watch ever, actually.
Agreed. Yeah. This is a watch. I agree with you. The first time I saw one in the metal, I was like, "Wow, this is small and kind of wearable, and like, you know, it's not
like a watch. It's like a watch-sized thing."
Yeah. But
it sounds silly to say, but it means, like, I think if you've only ever seen a picture of it on a big monitor or even on your phone, it's much smaller than it shows up on your phone. It's a stupid thing to say, but it's a watch-sized item. It's a watch designed by someone who knows a lot about watches.
It's also very three-dimensional. It doesn't come across in a flat picture how sort of like the steps of the different displays and the depth between the crystals and the dials and the case back. Like it's all very three-dimensional. But what kind of brought me around on this watch, because the first couple times I saw it, I was just like, this is not for me. This is not like, I get it, but I don't get it. But there's a lot of people who I really respect in watchmaking who have said like, this is the watch that changed everything for them. And they've kind of convinced me. So, I mean, we did in our, you know, a previous issue of the magazine in volume 4, the Hodinkee magazine, Max Busser from MBNF, former Hodinkee radio guest, talks about how like, this is the watch that changed everything for him. So we have this watch to thank in some ways for MBNF and all the countless people that Max has then inspired. But also like Eric Koo, who, you know, again, multiple time Hodinkee radio guest, and like somebody who in many ways has extremely classic taste in watches, you know, old Cartier, old Rolex, old Patek, you know, modern stuff like Acrivia, like really like high-end traditional watchmaking. Like this was the first crazy watch he ever bought, and like he wanted this forever. And, you know, it was kind of a symbol to him of kind of having made it and arrived in the watch world. And after talking to those two guys who obviously have very different perspectives on this industry and a handful of other people, I've come around. Like, I get it. I don't think I'd wear one. It's not my thing. But I got to say, I think it belongs on this list. I think if we look at it, kind of a lot of the people who are pushing watchmaking forward, they're saying that this inspired them. And for that alone, like, there we go.
Absolutely.
So next on the list, we're going back to something a little more traditional. In 2000, F.P. Journe released the Chronomet Resonance, the mostly referred to generally as the Resonance by most people. I love this watch, man. This is one of the first like really high-end watches that I ever got into. And like when I first, I knew about it before I joined Hodinkee, but one of the very first kind of events I attended after joining Hodinkee was a dinner with some Journe collectors, and seeing a handful of these all in one place at one time like blew my mind. It was a real watershed moment for me personally, and it kind of this is a watch that pushed me to learn how watchmaking works, not how watches look or can like fit into your personal style, which is kind of how I got into watches. But like wanting to understand how this watch worked and why it was so important and why so many seemingly smart, cool people were into it really kind of like pushed me deeper and deeper down the rabbit hole.
Like aesthetically, this might be one of the more traditional watches on this list.
Yeah.
In that it does reflect itself back. It does reflect its design back on the history of kind of advanced watchmaking. But then it's such a statement and it's such an achievement as a product that fits on your wrist that the other thing that I find interesting is you either know Journe or you don't. And if you don't, you could very easily just mistake it for being a name of a guy that existed in 1870 and started a brand and then it steamrolled into a Patek Philippe or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's really wild to know that he's not even that old.
No.
Jorn. I mean, this is a man still very much in his prime and operating the business entirely under his own wherewithal and continuing to make really large scale achievements in modern watchmaking. And talk about locked in aesthetic. You could see a Jorn from 40 feet. And if you know what you're looking at, you don't have to question whether it's a Jorn or not.
Yeah. Yeah. What are your thoughts, Sean?
Yeah, I mean, when I see this watch, I just think of, you know, Jorn and what he represents. I think it's like single-mindedness, a kind of a definite understanding of what one's approach is. I mean, he makes not only the movements, but he also designs these watches himself.
Yeah.
So this is really, I see kind of the singularity of one man's vision as applied to a craft. And that's what, to me, this watch represents.
I think there's a level of defiance in this watch too that I've always respected. Depending on who you talk to, some people will say that the concept of resonance doesn't exist. So for people who may not know, the chronometer resonance, the principle behind it is that the movement has two balances, two gear trains, and they're sort of like they keep one another in check by having the two balances extremely close to one another. And there's the idea of the sort of resonance effect that they, without touching, will impact one another and essentially like eliminate variation. They'll keep one another accurate. Some people think this is hokum. Some people think it's a pure scientific principle. It must be true. There's actually no like definitive answer to that question. It really does depend who you ask. And I think Jorn's decision to make like one of his flagship products this thing that like a lot of people think is total BS and other people think is pure genius is a statement about him and about how he sees his role in watchmaking and a statement about his own confidence. And, you know, in a world where a lot of watchmakers and watch brands are designed by committee and designed by, you know, marketing strategy, it's kind of cool that he sort of like put a flag in the ground and was like, come at me. Yeah. I really respect that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you're exactly right. That's actually really well put. That it's something that I hadn't considered that he had decided to put this watch that is, whose very, technology is controversial forward as, you know, one of his one or two most important lines of watches.
Yeah. Speaking of come at me watches, next one on our list, this is number 5, so we're halfway through the list. This is the Richard Mille RM001, the OG Richard Mille from 2001. I love this watch. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, aside from there's a reference in there that compared this watch to a 250 GTO Ferrari, which is such a bizarre comparison. The two are antithetical almost.
Yeah.
Aside from that one bit and way you and I can discuss that over the next drink wherever we find ourselves in the world. But aside from that, I mean, I feel like I'm long on record. Like Richard Mille is awesome. I love their watches. Yeah. I think they're crazy. I think they're cool, and they're no less crazy or cool when this one came out than now. The brand is still like pushing to do their own thing. They developed their own aesthetic, and you can spot them from across the room. You can spot them fake or real on a football player in a game. Like there's something special that people notice, and they don't look like a normal watch, and they don't represent normal technology. And certainly if this is the genesis of that concept, of that kind of outpouring of creativity, then absolutely this needs to be respected. It needs to be remembered. I think they're a remarkable modern brand, and I might compare them more to Pagani than a 60s Ferrari than but then if that's the case, then I love a Zonda, and I love an early Richard Mille.
I think there's no controversy in having a Richard Mille on this list. In fact, I think this list would kind of immediately toss this list out if it didn't include an early RM. It's hard to think of a brand that over the last 10 years, and especially over the last 5 years, has had like more broad cultural relevance. All right, let's keep moving on this. Let's go to 2001 Ulysse Nardin Freak, which, I don't know, to me, it feels like when I saw that this watch came out in 2001, I was like, huh, this feels like it's been around forever.
Yeah.
And I guess it hasn't, but also like that is almost 20 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's been around for a long time. It's one of the first watches to use silicon components in its construction.
Yeah.
It was way, way ahead of its time.
Yeah. UN doesn't get nearly enough credit for that.
Yeah, I mean, maybe not these days. I feel like they used to, but they're the guy who revived them, Rolf Schneider, has, you know, he passed away. I think it was 2011 or 2012. We may have to fact check that, but it's been some time since his influence has been felt in the watchmaking world. But yeah. You know, what he did with UN was nothing short of incredible, really.
Yeah, this is kind of a love or hate watch, though, right?
I think so. I would say with a lot on these lists, it doesn't matter if you like them or you don't like them. The list stands on its own, and this certainly, the Freak, is a modern avant-garde watch. It's one of the first that would come to memory. It's nearly 20 years ago, so it's like we're now cresting into it not being that modern.
Yeah.
And I think that aesthetically, there's not really much that looks like it. Functionally, it's fascinating to have so much of the movement be also part of the time telling mechanism, the display. Yeah. And then of course the setting without a crown was a pretty big deal then. Mm-hmm. And if you're gonna have a Longa one simply because of its age and Longa's relative youth in their current facet, there's no way you can build that without having the Freak. So
yeah, I gotta admit, I was kind of skeptical when I first saw this watch on the list. And at the very end of Victoria's comments on this watch, she quotes Jack, and Jack's quote is, single-handedly, the Freak inaugurated the era of the superwatch, mechanically sophisticated, visually arresting, unapologetically exotic. Honestly, Jack convinced me. Like, all I had to do was go 10 feet from my desk, 20 feet from my desk, and, like, there's the evidence. I think he won me over there.
Cool watch.
Yeah. Next up, we have another cool watch that I also think is important in a similar way, which is the Ehrwerk UR103 from 2003. Felix Baumgartner and Martin Fry are two of the coolest people in watchmaking. Like, I absolutely love those guys. They were in the office recently, and I was traveling, and I was kind of crushed. I didn't get a chance to catch up with them. This is Ehrwerk's another one. Like, they done changed the game.
This is a watch that uses, I guess, like planetary gears, and it's a planetary display, which is not something new, but the presentation and the way that they packaged it, and the way that they developed Ehrwerk as a brand around this concept is really nothing short of phenomenal.
Yeah, I think in the way that the Freak kind of inaugurated, well, let's go back even further down this list, right? Like, the Antiqua is a watch that it looks like a watch, it feels like a watch, but it looks and feels like a weird watch. The Freak looks like a watch on steroids. Like, it's totally, like, just maxed out. It's super mechanically interesting. It's a little big. It's kind of, like, in your face. This is one of the first watches that doesn't look like a watch. Like, if you're a normal person and you see this and you have no idea what you're looking at, you're like, what the hell am I looking at here? How do I tell the time? Why is, like, most of it metal and covered up? Like, where's the face? Like, this is a watch that, like, forces a conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where Ehrwerk, this watch came out in 2003. Ehrwerk started in 97. So, you know, they'd already been around for 6 years, but, I think this is another, like, watershed moment in the watch that doesn't look like a watch, which is how we get a lot of what we would call, like, haute horlogerie today.
Absolutely. I don't really have that much to add. I think Ehrwerk's incredible. I really love what they've done since then. Like, they've continued on the same path. They've refined the same idea. You now get these rotating satellite hour displays and crazy uses of luminous technology and amazing materials use in the case. They've become smaller and lighter, and never, you're never going to see one and not be happy to see it.
Agreed. Similarly to that, that's a great way to get to the next watch, which is 2010's HM4 from MB&F. I have said many, many times on the record that the thing I love about all of MB&F's watches that unites everything, all their watches, all their other creations, is the first time I see every one of them, I smile. Like, just reflexively. You know, they are fun. They bring joy to an industry that is sometimes very self-serious and sort of, like, nose in the air. And this is like, hey, look, we made something cool. Like, it's less about it being luxurious. It's less about it being mechanically complex. It's less about it being a first or innovative. It's just like, look, like, doesn't this make you happy? And then all the other stuff is there. It's all there. The substance is there. But it's just like, look at this thing. It puts a smile on your face. Isn't that nice?
Yeah, it's completely wild. You know, my favorite thing about this watch when I look at it is, you know, you have these two jet engines. It looks kind of like the last watch we talked about, nothing like a watch.
Mm-hmm.
It's so out there. But then you look at the dial for the time display and it's got the little Flieger triangle at the top. Oh yeah, it's just the pilot's watch.
Yeah, it's like it's so non. It's the least traditional take on like one of the most like the original wristwatch, essentially, or one of the original wristwatches.
I mean, the thing with it, I don't have really anything to add specific to the HM4. I think this is an incredible watch. I think you could have picked almost any of the HMs, and this is a great choice. I see these, and all I can think is it's personality in mechanical form.
Yeah.
So the watchmaking always speaks for itself. You already know the name that Max has picked to work with or integrate with or the designer, but it's how they bring everything together into a unit of something that kind of transcends just being an interesting design or being something that doesn't look like a watch but is. Or if it's a crazy clock, it's also a jellyfish that you can hang from your ceiling. Like, it's just raw personality, and they are so much fun. And often just an incredible breath of fresh air.
Yeah, agreed. Next up, we're getting close to the end. We have two watches left. The Bulgari Octo Finissimo Tourbillon from 2014. I mean, of course. Like, this is another one where I read this and I'm like, duh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Octo Finissimo range is an incredibly popular one today. It's certainly very popular at Hodinkee. I think we all love the Octo Finissimo. This Tourbillon, I think when it came out, was the thinnest. Tourbillon?
I believe so.
Thinnest automatic, thinnest Tourbillon, yeah. And it has three.
Yeah.
It's an incredibly thin watch, obviously. It's and yet it still has this very architectural look to it. It's got, you know, a stepped case. It's a beautiful thing. Bulgari did a very nice job adapting, you know, the original Genta DNA of the Octo into something that is totally, totally new and totally its own. And that, I think is very successful for them today.
Yeah. So those three records were, it was the thinnest automatic watch, thinnest automatic Tourbillon, and the thinnest Tourbillon.
Yeah.
Not too bad. Yeah, I mean, on the design side, I mean, Fabrizio Buonamassa, who's the head of design for Bulgari watchmaking, is the man.
He's a champion.
He's the coolest dude. He's amazing. He's Italian. He thinks like an Italian. He doesn't have the same sort of approach that the traditional Swiss designers have. And I love it. And like, you sit down with him and he always has a piece of paper in front of him. And like, you ask him a question, he draws you an answer. Like, he can't just like talk to you about it. He has to show you, which I love. I just got to see him a couple weeks ago, for Bulgari's launches in Shanghai. And I find every time I sit down with him, like, even if I'm not interviewing him for a particular story, I just want to sit and talk to the guy. Like, I learn something about watchmaking every time I talk to him. And I feel like every time I pick one of these Octo watches up, the Octo Finissimo watches, whether it's this Tourbillon or the time only in titanium or the time only in ceramic or
Chronograph GMT,
like whatever it is, I pick one of these watches up and I want it more than the time I picked it up before, which is a good sign, a dangerous sign, but a good sign. You know, and these watches get a lot of, I won't say flack, but it's you know, it's always part of the conversation that, oh, it's, you know, it's thin, it's angular, it kind of is based on a Genta design. On a bracelet, is it like another Nautilus Royal Oak competitor? And I would say no. Like, I think it's genuinely its own thing. And like, I will defend that pretty arduously. That's probably a topic for another time, but
I think it's definitely competition to those brands because it's excellent. I mean, if we're talking about competition, these are great watches that deserve to be in the running if you would like a watch that doesn't look like other watches you own or if you...
But it's not a Me Too product.
Not a Me Too product.
No, I don't see it that way at all. I actually see them as being very innovative and really establishing the brand as a forward thinking. Like, in 20 years, we may look back at the development of this line as the Royal Oak Offshore.
Yeah.
The next wave of a brand that was looking forward instead of just exclusively backwards.
And now a look at this week's sponsor. This is a time of year when it's hard not to think about the changing seasons. The air starts to feel crisp, the leaves start to turn golden, and the December holidays are quickly approaching. Over the last few weeks, we've told you about Grand Seiko's Special Seasons collection, which is only available in the United States and celebrates the unique feel of each of the four seasons. First up was the SBGH271 for summer, which has a stainless steel case and bracelet, a richly textured green dial with gold hands and markers, and an automatic high beat movement. The fall watch, the SBGH273, has the same case, bracelet, and movement, but with a stunning blue dial that nods to the color of the sky on a cool, clear autumn night. The winter and spring watches, though, are a little bit different. Both have titanium cases and bracelets paired with innovative spring drive movements. This means that the seconds hands glide smoothly over the distinctive, beautiful dials. The SBGA415 for winter has a gray dial with a mottled pattern inspired by snow glittering in the sunlight, while the SBGA413 for spring has a similarly patterned dial that's a soft pink color, a reference to the Japanese Sakura cherry blossoms that arrive with the warmer temperatures. This poetic, big-picture approach to watchmaking, where storytelling is every bit as important as technical excellence, is unique to Grand Seiko and perfectly exemplified in the Seasons collection. For more about the Seasons collection and Grand Seiko's other families of watches, visit GrandSeiko.com. All right, let's get back to the show. All right, last watch on this list. People are going to freak out, but they shouldn't. It's the Apple Watch 2014. Again, no brainer. Like you have to include that. And if you disagree with it because it is different in kind from the other watches on this list, like you should calm down, first of all. And two, like if this is a list about 10 watches that have changed what's on people's wrists, like the Apple Watch has undoubtedly been the most influential watch of
the
last
10,
20, 30 years. You know?
Yeah, it is the most influential watch on this list.
I would say this, the Apple Watch has to be the most influential watch since maybe the original Swatch.
Yeah, which doesn't appear on this list.
Timex Indiglo.
Timex Indiglo is
like
up there.
Like a triathlon, the Iron Man ones. Like, yep. The, you know, 1992, I was six when I got mine, so it's 1992.
Yep. Yeah. It's
G-Shock.
Yeah.
Also not on this list.
Yeah. But I think you'd make a whole list of watches that aren't high end watchmaking that also qualify. This is the only one that I think transcends both.
Yep.
Because I don't think there's many times, you guys can correct me if you're wrong, but if you've ever come across a guy who has a Longa One on one wrist and an Iron Man on the other wrist, probably not. But you do see guys in our office, for example, with a Longa One or a Speedy on one wrist and on the other wrist an Apple Watch.
Yeah. Agreed. You know, I think, yeah, again, we could do a whole hour long show for about sure. The influence of the Apple Watch in that way. But, I think it's interesting that, you know, Victoria talked to some like real diehard watch collectors and you get this like, oh, it's not a watch. It's a connected device that happens to be on your wrist. But like, I don't think that's true. Like, I think the Apple Watch is a watch. I think it's always been a watch. I think it's a better watch now than it was in 2014. We'll link up to my latest Apple Watch review. You can get my full take there. I'll leave that for that. But yeah, I mean, like in 2019, it looks like, according to Victoria's reporting, that the Apple Watch is going to outsell the entire Swiss watch industry by volume. And when you consider how many wrists that means, like this is a potent, influential cultural force, not just for watchmaking.
Yeah, I mean, every year they continue to add features that make it harder and harder to to avoid having one.
Yeah, you know? Totally. So before we wrap up, because we've run pretty long on this, but I just want to ask, do you guys have any watches that you think could have made the list? We don't have to knock anything off the list. I think everything on this list in some way or another deserves to be on the list, but I do think there are some omissions.
Yeah,
I'm not sure what I would pull out to swap in, but before we get into mine, what are some of your noted omissions?
Okay, I would say something from Blancpain. I mean, Blancpain came up earlier in the conversation, but I mean the fact that there is a thriving life around mechanical watches, Blancpain has a huge role to play in that, and that they're not on here, it surprises me a little bit. You know, some kind of complicated Blancpain, whether it's a 1735 watch or something like that.
Okay, interesting. Yeah. James, you have any?
I don't know what I would knock off this list. I think this is a great list. Mm-hmm. So I don't mean it as a knock, but I mean honorable mentions. Resence
is interesting. Yeah.
Debatune.
Tippitune, interesting.
You know, both younger than a lot of the brands that, that we're talking about, you know, into the certainly ones that include the 90s, unless I have the age wrong of either of these brands, but I don't think I do. HYT was doing, is, sure. was and is doing things that other brands just simply aren't. But I think that would come, a lot of these, I think even you could say all three of these, Dave Batune probably owes a lot to Vianney Halter.
Yeah.
Ressence owes a lot to just kind of the advances in mechanical watchmaking in general to make that idea yeah. possible.
Yeah.
And then certainly like with an HYT, I don't think you don't have HYT if there wasn't Opus. You don't have Opus without some right. that we've already talked about on here.
True.
Yeah. And it, maybe that's a simplification, but like I think you can, even if there weren't people in those camps that move between the parties, you can draw aesthetic lines between a lot of these ones.
Yeah, yeah, I would agree.
One other thing I would add too is maybe an IWC or a Zinn or some kind of like military type of design watch, because that's a huge category in watches yeah. today.
Do you think though that there were major strides made in the last 25 years? Like, has that archetype changed substantively?
That's a fair point.
That would be my only...
Yeah, but I'm just thinking more about like what's popular and what people yeah. are wearing.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a couple. One is the Cartier Ballon Bleu. From 2007. I think it's easy to forget now, since especially in the enthusiast side, we don't talk about the Ballon Bleu too much, but like there was a period there from like 2007 to like probably 2010 or 11, where like if you were like a relatively well-off stylish person in like a major city, like especially if you were a woman, you almost certainly had a Ballon Bleu. Like it was huge. The ad campaigns were ginormous. I mean, it was really like, it was almost like Cartier's like push back into watchmaking.
It was a huge success. When did that come out? That was
2007, which is later than I thought. Yeah. But I think that really like kicked off kind of the modern era of Cartier watchmaking.
Yeah.
I think the Hublot Big Bang is missing.
Sure. Honestly, Wow.
Honestly, I might knock off one of the more avant-garde independents from this list. I'm not sure who. I keep going back and forth. Like, it's hard to imagine this list without MBNF. It's hard to imagine it without Erwerk. It's hard to imagine it without Ulysse Nardin. But, like, I don't know. It's also hard to imagine this list without the Big Bang. Like, they're...
I mean, I think you could argue, though, that the offshore was kind of... It was an influence upon the Big Bang, right?
Yeah, but I think just, like, think about how many people wear Big Bangs.
Pure proliferation.
Yeah, I mean, Big Bang to me is up there with, like, RM in terms of, like... Most, I mean,
oh, totally.
If you want to think about like the three watches that have probably had the biggest cultural impact over the last 10 years, it's probably Richard Mille, Offshores, and Big Apple. Bangs are like the three watches,
or the Apple Watch,
yeah. Yeah, true.
Different categories, I suppose, but in the tone of this list, I mean, like, you know, if the idea is what has changed what people are wearing, I'm not sure I can make the case that Ressence is changing what people are wearing,
that's true.
But I do think that the Big Bang has changed watch aesthetics. I think you actually see like Big Bang and Royal Oak Offshore aesthetic in G-Shocks,
in
much more casual things that people are buying from department stores, not from boutiques, not from you know, things that you need trust fund money to purchase. Some of the aesthetic effect.
Love some good trust fund money.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
But there's an aesthetic effect to a lot of what's on this list that does filter down into other watches and into the Apple Watch.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of watches that are less expensive, another one, I'm not sure this warrants being on the list, especially if we're limiting it to 10 watches. I think this probably gets bumped off. But the Swatch System 51 from 2013, I think Swatch doing something kind of high profile and mechanical, I would have to see sales numbers. I have no idea, but I don't know. I think it's conceivable that this has like moved the needle for people in terms of mechanical watchmaking and might be kind of a gateway for people. I don't know if that's true. I could be completely wrong. That could be like a watch nerd perception, but yeah. I don't know. I think it was at least a watch that came to mind to me as like warranting conversation. Yeah.
The other one that I wanted to consider, and I don't think it has a place on this at all, but if you just want to talk about what people are wearing that feels different than when I got into watches, it's Apple Watches, because you see them everywhere.
Yeah.
Ubiquitous,
and it's Garmin Athletic Watches.
Yeah.
Which I see everywhere, no matter where I go, anywhere in the world, at every airport, everyone has one of these watches.
I mean,
I see Apple Watches, and I see Garmin Vivo Fits and 925 Runners and Phoenixes.
I mean, just everywhere. Shout out to my wife, Laura, who loves her Garmin.
As do I. I have a Phoenix 6.
Absolutely loves it, and it's great. It's a great product.
I just like those are the ones that I think have really captured the heart of the non-enthusiast watch appreciator, where their last watch was probably a Triathlon or G-Shock or maybe an old Swatch or something like that, and now it's an Apple Watch or it's a Garmin, and it's based on expanding into other aspects of their lifestyle.
Yeah. So the last one that I want to talk about, this again, a little nerdy, but the Tudor Heritage Black Bay 2012. You know, one of the biggest trends we've seen in watchmaking over the last couple of years has been this idea of the like faux vintage aesthetic, the idea of bringing kind of like traits back from the heyday. And I think we can credit the Black Bay with kicking that off. I mean, I can't really think of a watch before 2012 that had that level sort of like general like cultural penetration. You know, like it really, especially when Tudor came back to the US for US customers, that was a, it was huge. It was a huge thing. And like you saw all the guys over at GQ wearing them, all the guys over at Esquire wearing them, you know, all our buddies in the sort of like outdoor tech streetwear, like guy who was interested in style all of a sudden was like, shit, I want a watch that looks like an old watch. And you know, a lot of those guys now are buying actual vintage watches or are buying modern watches that they got into because Tudor was a gateway for them. That to me, honestly, that and the Big Bang probably to me were the two watches that like it felt hard to have this list feel complete without them.
Yeah, I would agree with you. However, I would say I think the situation with Tudor was a slightly more complex because that had to do also with the return of Tudor to the United States.
That's fair.
And I think Tudor was just a force. I mean, Rolex made Tudor a force when they came back.
And I think Longines owes. Is owed some credit for kind of kicking off Longines and Oris.
I would say Tag Heuer as well.
For sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Cool.
I think Tudor maybe did it better than other people, but maybe there was already a little bit of a wave forming that they got to the top of with Rolex money and with, let's face it, an incredible design. Those are great watches.
They're fantastic watches.
And they continue to evolve and remain relevant today. I mean, the Black Bay 58, come on.
Yeah, I got the same shock, like, again, when I looked this up, and it was, like, 2012. I was like, shit, that's 7 years ago.
Yeah.
And if you think about the fact that it was released at Baselworld in March, it was almost 8 years ago. You know, we're only a couple months away from that being 8 years ago, and those watches still look fresh. They look great. Even the original Burgundy Black Bay still looks
awesome. It's still a great watch.
Yeah. So, cool. Thanks, Victoria, for putting this story together. Shout out to Victoria Gamelski.
Good read.
Yeah, great story, and it's really great, you know, for all of us. We love anytime somebody like the New York Times does something thoughtful like this. That's right. Not just like, you know, watch spotted on so-and-so, some new sponsorship, some new whatever, you know, let's report on the numbers coming out of Switzerland, but does like a real deep dive into watch culture. I think it's a good thing for all of us. You know, it's a good thing to get. Anytime my non-watch collector friends are texting me links to watch stories, that's a good thing. Like if these things are getting on those people's radar, I'm a happy person, and even more so when it's thoughtful quality coverage put together by somebody good. And hey, we got some pod time out of it.
Yeah, go back, read the post. It's solid.
Yeah, we'll link to it, and you should go check it out. It'll be in the show notes and on the post on hodinkee.com. And maybe we'll have to do another episode where each person puts together a list like this.
That'd be cool.
Yeah. All right. Sure. Maybe next time. Awesome. Thanks, guys. And up next, we've got my conversation with Asher Rapkin and Gabe Riley of Collective. Good to see you guys. Good to have you here at Hodinkee HQ.
It's fantastic to be here. Thanks for having us.
Yeah. It's not quite West Coast weather out. It's like gray and cold and misting, but I hope you guys don't regret making the trip out.
No. So when I moved from New York to California, like one of the things that I missed more than anything was like actual weather. So,
oh,
like,
yeah.
Misting, but not humid is my like, it's my New York dream.
Also, we're not on fire, which is nice.
Too soon.
I mean, no. I was not making a joke. Like I was in LA last week and like, got out just in time.
Yeah, it's a thing, man.
Yeah.
And we live, I live up just north of Los Angeles, right up against a hill.
Oh, geez.
So, you know, it's like beautiful vistas, torching.
Oof.
Yeah.
No good.
No. Good start, though.
Yeah, good start. good way to start the show. Let's talk about wildfires.
Absolutely.
So we've actually, Asher, we've known each other for a little while, and we just met. But how did you guys get to know each other?
Oh, boy.
You want to take this one, Gabe?
Yeah, sure. So Asher and I, we both grew up here in New York City in Manhattan, and we went to school together. So we met each other in homeroom in the seventh grade.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is not like a watch friendship. This is something that goes like way beyond.
It goes way deep. This is a subject of many podcasts, but you know,
it didn't even start with a friendship.
Yeah. It didn't even start with a friendship. But that again, a story for another time. I think but watches do figure in it in a pretty big way. So although we grew up here in New York, we went to college in different places, we've lived in different parts of the country. And really, especially in the last 15, 10 years, one of the things that's kept us close as friends, regardless of where we are geographically, has been like the shared interest in watches.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that I think, you know, and probably a lot of people can relate. You know, we grow up, we make these really close friendships in high school or in college or from home. And then you're 21 and you like, you know, you disperse, right?
Yeah, right.
And even though you care about people and you love people and you want to stay in touch with them, as life happens, it gets harder and harder. But the thing that keeps you together, and I'm sure like sports fanatics can, you know, will say the exact same thing, is if you're really obsessive about a particular topic, when you see something new, like you're going to call one person who's actually going to care about that thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right. Because
you could turn to the person next to you at your desk and you're like, oh man, check this out. And they're like, what are you talking about?
Why are we having this conversation?
Exactly. Yeah. So you're like, ah, all right, I'll call Gabe.
Yeah.
And nice. That's a friendship persists.
I mean, not a bad way to stay friends.
No.
So how did you each get into watches? Did this happen at the same time? Did this happen separately? Did one of you ruin the other?
I think it was probably about the same time. I've always been into watches, or at least since I can remember. I grew up in the 80s with a brother who's 10 years older, and my first memories of watches were Swatch watches. Okay. That was a huge thing, and for him being a bit older than I was, like he was a teenager when Swatch was kind of came out and was raging and was a cultural phenomenon, and I thought that was cool. And then as I got older, I got into the Timex Iron Man.
Yeah.
And I think that set me on like my particular taste in watches, which are sort of tool watches, things that are rugged, built for a purpose, and can really kind of, as Timex would say, take a licking. And then it sort of evolved from there. I think the thing that got me into mechanical watches was James Bond, again, you know, the famous Omega Seamaster, the Pierce Brosnan. Because again, it's a rugged tool watch built for a purpose, can take a beating. And I think that was probably around the same time that Asher got involved as well. And he has a great story about the Omega Seamaster.
All right, to his
humiliation, it must be shared.
To my extraordinary humiliation to be now shared with the entire global watch community.
That's what we love. Yeah, that's totally. What we're here for.
So actually, before I tell you that, just because you're reminding me of something. So there used to be in New York these electronic stores that were just like bric-a-brac electronic stores.
Yeah.
You know the ones I'm talking about?
Yeah,
They used to be in like Midtown, and you know, I grew up on the Upper West Side, so around there too. And you know, you'd go in and you know, you'd be like, hey, you know, I want to buy a camera. And suddenly they would have like every camera available to you, yep. Which is incredibly shady. But you know, anyway, they also used to sell Casio. They also used to sell like Casio calculator watches.
Okay.
Like, I feel like just thinking back, like I always think of like my dad's watch being like the thing that got me into watches. But honestly, it probably was Casio calculator watches, which really should paint a picture of what I looked like in seventh grade. But back to my story.
Mega complication.
Yeah, exactly. Back to my story of great humiliation. So growing up as a teenager, you know, my dad always wore and to this day still pretty much does wear a beautiful little blue dialed 36 millimeter date chest that he bought about a year after marrying my mom.
Okay.
And you know, like growing up, like I have so many things associated with that, like going on vacation and seeing that, or just watching him type, or even just like the rattle of the bracelet. I know it sounds nuts, but it's like something I very much associate with like my dad, you know, sitting at his desk and writing. And you know, I aspired to and always wanted, like, to my mind, I'm like, the watch I will own one day is that Rolex, you know? And obviously that was an extraordinary amount of money, and the idea of buying that was like long out of reach for most of my life. And I remember seeing when I went to visit Gabe like 12, 13 years ago in San Francisco, he was wearing a tag. What was it? It was like Aqua Racer.
The Aqua Racer.
Yeah, it was like a, yeah. It was actually like a really nice Aqua Racer. Watch. Yeah, super clean, beautiful. And I was like, that's a badass watch. And I was like, where'd you get it? And he's like, Amazon. I'm like, yeah, that's how you buy watches. So I started like,
wait. Buying a watch on Amazon 12 years ago, 13 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
That was like really early buying watches online.
Yeah. You know, it was a leap of faith, but the price was right. It was right around the transition between references on the Aqua Racer. And so basically, I think some seller on Amazon was using it to dump stock. And oh my, I couldn't believe I could get an Aqua Racer for, you know, whatever the price was at the time. And I loved that watch. I wore it on my wedding day.
So I was inspired by this watch, and I was working at, I used to work in television. I was working at this one network, and I left to go to another network, and I got like promoted. I'm like, all right, now is the time to get a proper watch. So feel free to bleep this if you'd like, but I went to the Torno Time Machine.
Okay. We're not going to bleep that. That's fine.
Wait. So I go to the Torno Time Machine,
okay.
And I go in, and I'm like, you know, the watch I really aspire to own is this Bond, you know, I didn't even know that's what it was, but like this Bond Seamaster, right? Like sword hands, like beautiful piece. And they had one in the pre-owned box. And I'm like, that watch is awesome. And I'm like, how much is it? And they're like, that watch is $1,600. Whew. All right. And I'm like, it's an automatic watch, right? And they're like, sure. So I'm like, oh, okay, cool. Now I don't know anything about anything at this point. I'm
sure is never a good answer. Yeah, right. When you ask somebody who's selling you something and you ask a question, they're like, yeah, sure.
Yeah, sure.
That's never good.
Oh, and it gets even worse because like I totally bought the watch protection plan too. I mean, walked right through the meat grinder. Long story short, I totally bought like a quartz Seamaster, which was revealed to me because I proudly like wore it because Gabe and I were going to a concert a couple days later. I'm like, look, I finally got it. He's like, why'd you buy a quartz Seamaster? And I'm like, it's not. Oh,
shit.
Right.
Now, here's what makes that reference cool. In Pierce Brosnan's first appearance as James Bond, so in GoldenEye, he's actually wearing a quartz Seamaster. It wasn't until the later films when he transitioned to...
Yeah, but I can't retroactively claim that.
To automatic.
Yeah. Right.
But it's...
I mean, you could.
It's still legit.
But you know what, though? But honestly, I think that this is a journey that probably a lot of people who are buying watches can sympathize with.
For sure.
Right? Because you go into these stores and you're all intimidated about like what's happening, and it's, you know, like you look at these things and they're monstrously, teeth-rattlingly expensive, and, you know, you trust the person across from you to sell you the thing that you want. And then you find out, like, you know, that the nightmare that you thought was going to happen actually happened.
Yeah.
Which in all honesty, I think is like a journey that a lot of collectors go through, you know, whether you like get into vintage and you start buying something and you find out that it's like a Frankenwatch or, you know, and I've been
for
there
sure.
too.
Yeah.
And no matter how much you know, like there's always that exploitative opportunity. And this is what has been a challenge as a collector and like someone who's passionate. And honestly, like, you know, part of the reason why Gabe and I like have started doing what we're doing, because we want to break people out of this like adversarial relationship that can sometimes come up between you and the person trying to sell you something.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a tough thing. Cause it's bad for everyone. Like it's bad for the whole watch world when something like that happens, because like you're obviously made of sterner stuff and you kind of like stuck through it and you had a passion for this. So like you ended up being a watch collector anyway. But if you were some guy who just walked in and was like, oh, I want my first nice watch, you buy this watch, you find out it's not what you thought it was, like most people, that's it. You're never buying another watch again. You go spend your money on cars or travel or cameras or whatever, and you're done. And the whole industry loses not just one customer, but it loses everybody who that customer then talks to and tells about this experience. So it's something that like the whole industry needs to get better at, as opposed to just it being about one store or one sales associate.
So this is a really, really like important topic and something that I think, you know, just Gabe and I think about, because, you know, aside from what we do with the collective, you know, we're also marketers. Like,
yeah,
we've worked in advertising, we work in marketing. Like this is something that we just think about, which is, you know, how to build a relationship, like what persuasion really comes down to. And in my mind, like the places that have fostered meaningful community or built a relationship have generally done it because the people on the other side of the transaction are genuinely passionate and excited about, you know, what they're trying to bring to you. And it's,
yeah,
you know, they're not like, of course they want to sell you something. It's their job. It's their livelihood. Like, right. It's business. But,
yeah.
But there's a distinction between that and like what we would refer to as the like, oh, but sir mentality, you know, where you would like the traditional stilted luxury approach where you walk into this incredibly ornate store and, you know, before you know it, there's someone who's pulled something out and telling you, like, wouldn't you love to treat yourself today? And a calculator's in their hand, and you're, like, racing towards a purchase, you know, and you don't want it. That's not why you're there. You know, maybe you're just an admirer and you want to, like, spend some time considering, and instead you're just being, like, shoved down this pipe. And it's a terrible experience. And I think for a lot of people, and I, you know, myself included, like, for a lot of folks that were excited about this hobby and wanted to get their hands on pieces to learn about them, to experience them, you know, long before I ever had the means to acquire them, that cuts those people out. Because if they walk in and they immediately feel like they're going to be compelled to try and buy, like, a car's worth of watch that with money they don't have, not only does that leave a bad taste in someone's mouth, it, to your point, I think diminishes and ruins an on-ramp that's critical for bringing new customers into the pipe.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in this world, right? And I've got some watches, and I've been around the block. I still get freaked out going to a lot of retail locations, authorized dealers. And I think, you know, in California, it's a little bit different. The vibe in and some of the dealers is a little bit different, a little less formal. I think they tend to be a little bit more open-minded, because someone could walk in with sweatpants and, you know, walk out with a
$50,000 Royal Oak.
Something insane. But when I come here, or I go, if we go to London or other places, I frankly sometimes just don't even enjoy it, or I enjoy it because I love watches and I love seeing them, but I feel uncomfortable and freaked out. And like, I'm probably one of the people who should feel the least freaked out. So something isn't quite right.
You know, but then if you flip it around, like, there are some people that, like, do it right. You know, like,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, a good example, you know, here in New York, a store that I was, like, vastly intimidated by for all the wrong reasons is Cellini.
Yeah.
And you're right. And like, I've been, and I go in there all the time now, and they're like, they couldn't be more hospitable. Like,
they're great.
Sweet. They're wonderful people.
Yeah, they're great.
Yeah. And they're just, I mean, and they've got watches in there that, you know, will melt your face, mm-hmm. from MB&F all the way up to, like, Cari's. Like, I mean, these are masterpieces. It's a museum.
Yeah.
And I think they recognize and appreciate that if you walk in there and you're like, whoa. Oh my God, like, can I see that? You know, like, I've never seen this Grunewald, or I've never seen that Cari, and I'd love to hold it and look at it and feel it and, you know, spend some time with it under a loop. And they know that you're probably, like, not the guy who's going to be like, you know what? Here's $150,000, you know, like,
right.
That's probably unlikely.
Yeah.
But they also know that maybe, you know, 10, 15, 20 years from now, maybe that's a thing you'll do.
Yeah. Or, like, you'll buy something else from them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. There's that too.
Or you'll tell somebody else who can afford it, or who wants to afford it, and they'll buy it. Like, they love watches and they get it. And I think you guys both touched on it as, like, what separates the good guys from the bad guys is just loving this thing, right? Like, you have to care. And that's whether you're selling watches or cars or whatever widget you're selling. Like, you have to care. If you don't care, people can tell. People aren't stupid.
Well, yeah. And what's been interesting too is how some of the steel sports shortage has changed the dynamic of this. You know, I think that because now there's so many of these pieces that so many people want, you know, and like the watch collecting world has been, like, so focused on, like, 5, 10, 20 references.
Mm-hmm.
All the ancillary references that are in orbit of those get, like, shotgun marketed to people. And I feel like folks, you know, are like, well, since I can't get that BLRO, or since I can't get that 15202 or whatever, you know, I'm gonna plunk down the money for a watch I half want because I'm worried that someone else is gonna get it. And then a dealer becomes more of a dealer and less of a, like, you know, partner in your collecting journey, or, you know, a facilitator of community. And I think that this is gonna be a situation that's gonna really backfire should we hit an economic downturn. And I think it's also a thing that's going to really backfire from a collecting perspective, because ultimately the reason you should be buying something to begin with is because you really, truly, honestly love it, in my opinion, not because it's, you know, kind of like the thing that you really sort of like, but in gold. You
right.
know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
Or like,
can I have this? You can have it in gold.
Exactly.
Yeah. Which is something that, like, actually gets said to people in stores.
100%.
If you haven't walked in, if you're listening to this and you haven't walked into an AD recently and, like, asked to see a Daytona, just do it. Like, just go to a retailer and see what the reaction is, because it's pretty appalling depending on where you go.
Well, actually, with the Daytona, it's like, we probably, you know, like, we don't have that in gold either. But hey, you want a platinum day date?
Right.
You know, and so it's like they're just going to keep. But anyway, my point is like those are all watches that are amazing pieces, but are in orbit around the watch that the person probably came in to get.
Yeah.
And if that upsell trajectory keeps going, you know, should we hit a point where the economy is not as robust as it is right now, that's going to collapse.
Yeah.
And the reputation, I think, of a lot of those dealers that have been living on this like ladder of like increased value based on lack of availability will be tarnished versus those other folks that maybe, you know, maybe it takes them 6 to 8 months to deliver the piece you want, but like you really got the watch you wanted.
Yeah.
And they really, you know, they really like were able to figure out how to do that. And they have that long-term value thought as opposed to near-term gain. And those are the folks I think are really going to drive the future community of what we're going to see.
Yeah.
Be successful in my opinion.
Yeah. No, I would totally agree. You guys have mentioned it briefly, but I want to make sure we really get into it.
Yeah.
You are the co-founders of a thing called The Collective. Can you tell us what that is?
Sure.
Yeah, sure. So Collective is it's a group of watch enthusiasts. And there's two things we do. So oftentimes a question we get asked is like, well, how are you guys and, you know, what Collective is? How is that different from other watch enthusiast groups or watch clubs or whatever? Good question. There's two things. First is the way we run our community. So we have a community of people. There's 50 of us right now. And we kind of get together and organize in two ways. One is in the digital world. We have a Facebook group, private Facebook group for the folks in our community. And that's a place where we have discussions like other watch collecting groups do. But the reason we did it on Facebook is because you can't hide behind a screen name on Facebook. You're your true self on Facebook. And what that does is it means the conversation is generally a lot more civil than what you see sometimes in Instagram comments or comments on Hodinkee's site or on the watch forums. Yeah. And that was important to us to have like a civil conversation about watches. And I actually catch myself when I'm posting in that group, kind of like moderating myself a little bit because I have to remember like this isn't the place to be a jerk or hide behind a screen name.
Yeah.
Like, I am who I am and everyone knows that. So that's one way. The other way is we get together in person, but the way we get together in person is a bit more focused than other collector groups. So we tend to get together with the group, with a brand and do something focused. Maybe it's a dinner with a watchmaker or a novelties preview or something like that. So cool. We try to bring things to the group in terms of events or get together so that people kind of couldn't organize on their own so that it's special. The other way we're different is through collaborations. So this is a perfect transition from what Asher was just talking about. You know, it can be frustrating being a watch enthusiast right now. Like some of the pieces we would consider like bread and butter. And I know that's not to be taken lightly. These are expensive pieces, but bread and butter pieces to someone who's a watch enthusiast are near impossible to get. And so we decided to sort of do what, you know, a little bit of collective bargaining, which is put the power of getting our hands on the watches we want in our own hands. And so by combining with a group of 50 people, and working with brands, we're able to make watches together with brands we love that we love. And so that's how it's different is the community runs a little bit differently, but the focus on collaboration, I think, is the thing, that makes it really unique.
Yeah. And, you know, for us, it was a tough one because, you know, we limit what we're doing to membership, not because we want to be highfalutin. I mean, what we're trying to do is we're trying to get to know the people that are in the group. And then we do intend to continue to expand it. But we hope to get to a point where everybody in that group knows each other, both in person and online.
Okay.
And that the relationships that are being built there are really meaningful. And, you know, what's interesting, just seeing some of the chemistry of what's been happening, you know, like there's a couple of group members who have discovered like a shared love of photography and like they're having sidebar conversations about that, you know, and there's some other folks that are collectors of some really wild watches that like, and I'm not talking about like crazy expensive pieces, just really like out there pieces, you know, which some folks, including myself, had never even heard of. And they feel comfortable and confident being able to share and you know, post these because it's not on a forum where, in all candor, like you could become a target. You know, it's not something where they're worried about being judged. They can just say, like, this is something that I find aesthetically appealing and I want to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you know, so much of what the discourse, the modern discourse in like forums and communities is about like comparing what I have to what you have, or getting someone's opinion. And when things are so subjective, like I'm sure everyone in this group has been in some group where someone has posted, hey guys, my AD called me. Should I get the BLNR or the BLRO? Like that's not
whatever you want. Yeah, like, fine. Like, you know,
exactly. Live your life, man.
Yeah.
But when you actually get into a conversation where someone's like, you know, I really don't understand like this particular intricacy, or like, how does Grand Seiko make this dial, or like, what it, you know, or hey, just a little thing like, why do you care about this? Help me understand it.
Yeah.
And the other thing you start to learn are that different people have like different triggers around what they consider like a difficult conversation. One example is there was a member who messaged me recently, and you know, I was talking about a specific reference in 42 millimeters, and I have a little baby wrist, so a 42 millimeter watch doesn't fit me. Mm-hmm. And I made a comment about how I had wished that that reference was available in 42 mil, and I got a message from the, or 38 mil, and I got a message from the guy being like, man, can you just stop that? Like, I'm a bigger guy, and like, I hate this trend, and like, when people talk about it like that, I read it as like a negative thing, and I get turned off, and I don't want to be part of this anymore, because all you're doing is telling me that like, you know, that what I like is wrong.
And, interesting.
Right? And I was like, wow, geez, man, it never even occurred to me. And it doesn't mean that we have to like walk over, you know, act like we're walking on eggshells or like tread on, you know, territory softly. But it's just interesting to realize like what can turn someone on or turn someone off, and how something that you may not even realize is a big deal is like fundamental to the way that they think about how they collect and like what matters to them.
That's really interesting. I mean, I wonder. You know, you talked about one of the reasons for doing this on Facebook is that it forces people to kind of be themselves. Have you guys found any other sort of like insights into either like particular collectors' idiosyncrasies or kind of like idiosyncrasies of the community at large that you've kind of discovered through these conversations that you don't think have manifested elsewhere?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so the thing that surprised me is the diversity of discussion and the open-mindedness of discussion. So for example, could you guess what the number one most discussed group by miles is in our Facebook group? Number one most discussed brand?
No.
Grand Seiko.
That's not that surprising.
But it's quite different from the things that are most often discussed in some of the other channels where we participate. For sure. As well. And I think it's also not really surprising given, you know, most of the people who are in Collective are West Coast based. We have people all over the world, but most of them are in California. And so there's, I think, an appreciation for the engineering and the technical accomplishments of Grand Seiko. But like, yeah, by far, that's the thing people want to talk about most. The other thing that's interesting is just, and Asher was saying this a little bit, like the diversity of what I've discovered more esoteric references of pieces I didn't know existed in this group of 50 people than I see on Instagram in a community of millions of people who are posting. And granted, you can go down a rabbit hole on Instagram and explore hashtags and all sorts of brands, but like, there are some really oddball pieces. There was an amazing Reverso chronograph that someone posted the other day that I had no idea existed, and it like blew my mind. And it's like, that's not like necessarily like a hot watch to talk about or something to signal with online, you know, to get a bunch of likes or things like that. But I just appreciated that someone's like, this is a watch I love that maybe doesn't get a lot of discussion or attention elsewhere. I'm going to share it here. So I've been just shocked by kind of like the diversity of conversation. When we first opened up the group, I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to do hyperbole, but it was days, maybe a week or more before someone posted about Rolex, which was really kind of crazy.
That is,
And so that's what's been interesting. Like, you've got a small kind of tight knit group of people off in a random corner of the internet, but there's so much diversity in terms of what's being discussed.
I think it's also an example, you know, and you asked about this at the beginning, you know, of what. One of the many things that I think differentiates Northern California watch culture from some of the other parts of the United States. And what's interesting, you know, about what sort of happened in NorCal is there are a couple of, well, there's lots of watch collector groups for sure, But there's a couple of dealers in particular that have sort of cultivated their own community. You know, if mm-hmm. you think about it, like you can probably think of a couple off the top of your head, right?
Yeah.
So like H.K. Milton is like, you know, probably like one of the pioneers of that.
Totally.
You know, our friend Rob Kaplan over at Topper Jewelers is another one. You know, like he's really like created a pretty amazing community around brands that are really hot and popular now, like Oris and Zodiac. But you can remember a time when those were deep cuts.
Yeah.
You know, and like,
if you were into that, you were a big nerd.
Totally. Like if you go back like 5 years and like, check out my Seawolf, someone's probably like, huh?
What? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, but like Rob was onto that. And those guys, I think, you know, created a home for people that were into that kind of thing. And believe it or not, you know, I think people might be surprised to hear this, but same thing actually around the Tiffany Paddock boutique. Like the vibe in there and the gentleman who runs it is a incredibly warm and welcoming guy who is just a massive watch nerd himself. And going in there to learn about the history of that, you know, like those two brands, let alone, you know, just to open your mind to Paddock in general, which I think yeah. for a lot of people can be intimidating.
For sure.
Is entirely possible there. So, you know, we saw this where it's like you start to see these groups of folks who might be shy or might be nervous or, you know, unlike other parts of the country, might have means but don't want you to know it. And bringing them together to a place where they're actually able to share in a passion, to learn from one another, and not feel like they are, you know, there to like drink half a glass of like champagne and then be shuffled down to yeah. the credit card machine.
Yeah.
So we saw that kind of a vibe, and we wanted to find a way to bring that into the digital space. And that's where the collaboration came in too, where it's like, well, okay, if we're going to do this and we're going to create a place where people can get together, how do we also do our best to look at the kinds of themes and interests that come out of that group to create the pieces that we hope and that we believe the people in that group really wanted more than anything.
And so the first collaboration you did was with Zenith, right?
Correct. So the first piece we did, which we'll deliver very shortly, was based on the El Primero.
Yeah.
And based on the Chronomaster platform. And this is a watch that both Gabe and I have always just absolutely loved. And, you know, frankly, I probably owe my passion for it to you guys, because I remember, you know, you guys educated me, honestly, on like the history of the El Primero, and after that, I went down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, we'll link up some of those stories in the show notes. We've spilled a lot of ink, shall we say, about the El Primero over the
totally.
Years.
Totally. And I think the truth of it is, like, there, we had never really found the El Primero that like fundamentally spoke to us, and that's, you know, that's not because there aren't a million references out there that are stunning, but we wanted to take it to the place that, you know, like, what is the El Primero that we had always really wanted, and how do we filter that El Primero through the aesthetic of the community that we're building for?
Yeah.
Which isn't to say that this is how we're going to approach every piece that we make. It certainly isn't. But for this first piece, we thought, you know, like, how do we take the reductive and simplified approach of the digital products that we work on and apply that to a incredibly forward-thinking and deeply storied and historical reference? So how do we apply the two without removing the core DNA? And that's where we landed with this particular piece. And, you know, it's an incredibly humbling process, because neither Gabe nor I is a watch designer. And we don't pretend to be, you know, we are creatives in the sense we work in advertising. We know how to write a brief and know how to build from that brief. We know how to build for a community. And that
we know how to use Photoshop.
We know how to use Photoshop.
Watch out, world.
Critical,
it's a dangerous
skill.
Thing.
Exactly.
Critical skill.
But what's been really exciting is, like, it's brought Zenith, who, by the way, was like just a magnificent company to work with. They were just wonderful, and bringing, like, being able to bring them closer to the collector. And I think this is one of the more interesting opportunities and things that I imagine we're going to see more and more of in the future.
Yeah.
Like, it used to be that, like, these brands didn't want to have, I wouldn't put it this way, but like the distance between the brand and the collector was really far.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at a brand like Rolex, like, they don't really know who their customers are. I mean, maybe they know who, like, their super ultra high end, maybe they know who owns a Rainbow Daytona, but they probably don't know who owns, like, rank and file pieces. And I think that But Rolex collectors, you know, have a deep desire to be connected to that company.
Yeah.
And I suspect as we get closer and closer and closer, you know, with these kinds of communities becoming more and more pervasive around the world, that we're going to see a closing in of the relationship between the customer and like the end user collector,
yeah,
and the brand. And whether that's facilitated through folks like Collective or through other types of relationships, that's going to, I think, be one of the bridges that's going to take us to the next generation of watch collecting.
Yeah.
What is that intimate relationship that we're going to start to have with these people that are making the things we care so much about?
Yeah, I totally agree. For people who may not have seen the watch, can you describe the Collective El Primero?
We have it here if you'd like
to see it. Oh, you do? I have not seen it in the metal yet.
We do.
Yeah.
So Asher can bust it out for you.
Yeah,
talk about it while I do that?
Sure.
Yeah.
Cool. So one of the amazing things about Zenith, right, is like it's a brand that has like a very distinct point of view. They don't do a ton of limited editions. Like they really focus on their DNA and their strengths. And so the El Primero Chronomaster has a very distinct point of view. And I think for us, we saw that as an opportunity, which was like, okay, well, what if we take the Chronomaster platform and what if we were just to sort of work with Zenith and push it in a direction that really spoke more directly to us. So what we've got here, Asher is, oh, there's a piece of plastic on it. How official. So what we've got here is it's a Chronomaster. It's a 38 millimeter piece. One of the things you'll notice first about it, no date. So that's pretty unique among El Primeros, particularly of this size. And then the watch itself is very monochromatic. So the watch dial is largely white with sort of gray accents. You guys wrote an amazing article. Jack wrote a piece about Collective and the watch, so I'm sure we can link up so people
can take
a look. I think the detail we love most about the watch was in the case finishing. In particular, the pushers are satined, not polished. And so it just has like this more kind of utilitarian, monochromatic look. And I think the idea for us was like, let's make a watch, an El Primero for Silicon Valley. And so hopefully you see some of the sort of product design language of Silicon Valley reflected in the watch. And I think what Zenith, you know, enjoyed working with us on that watch was the fact that we took something in a direction that they probably wouldn't have done on their own. And it was like truly a collaboration in that way. Like we tried to respect and worked with them to respect the DNA of the brand. I think we were... The one thing we did right in this was we sort of took a page from Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett's right-hand man. And, you know, Charlie Munger says his secret to success is knowing the outer limits of his competency. We respected the outer limits of our competency, and we really deferred to the product team at Zenith around finishing, materials, frankly, colors, and all that sort of stuff. And we put the concept in their hand and really let them run with it. And I think that's what worked well.
Yeah, and you know what? That was actually really interesting because, you know, we've done a couple other collaborations for different groups, never Collective and never at this scale. And you know, some watch companies are very open and excited to work with you, but it's like you're placing a special order.
Right.
You know, so you're like, okay, we're going to get 50 and we're going to change that dial. And it's like, we'll either approve that or we won't. And I think the thing that was really remarkable about Zenith is one of their lead designers, a gentleman named Roman Marietta, who was also just a lovely guy. You know, he really took this project on and interpreted what we were doing into their design language. And we went back and forth. We went through multiple prototypes. You know, I have a long WhatsApp thread with him that's like, you know, debating like this particular detail or that particular detail. And, you know, in the moment, like we were just thinking about it as a project that, you know, we're working on. Like I said, you know, we do lots of creative projects as a normal creative process. But when you take a step back and you consider the amount of time and energy and partnership that went into it, it honestly really speaks to Zenith as a brand and how much they cared about wanting to deliver for a community. Because 50 pieces is a lot of watches to sell. But for a company like Zenith, like it's not a large percentage of their total sales.
Not at all.
So being able to, so just thinking that they put that much time and effort into it is something that I am deeply humbled and appreciative of.
That's awesome. Yeah, I mean the watch looks beautiful. Yeah, the gray on the dial is this really nice sort of warm shade of gray. I really love it. And the satin finishes on the case. You've still got the like polishing on the bevels. It's nice. It's a sharp looking watch. And so you're making 50 of these?
We're making 50 plus the prototype you're holding.
Amazing. Yeah, it's beautiful. We'll include a picture of this in the story. So if you want to see it, go visit hodinkee.com and check out the post. We'll have a photo of this in there. Yeah, it's beautiful. Nicely done.
Thank you.
We touched on it a little bit, but something I want to make sure we talk about is sort of the uniqueness of California watch culture. I mean, you guys are both from New York. You know what the watch culture is like here. You know, I've found Ingo, I go to California pretty regularly. Was in LA last week and in San Francisco a couple weeks ago. And the watch cultures there are definitely different than what you find here in New York. It has its own kind of flavor, and I'd love to get your take on that. Like, how would you describe the sort of unique flavor of California watch culture?
I think there's a few interesting things that come to mind. I'm curious to hear what Asher says. Now, he's moved from the Bay Area down to the Los Angeles area, and that's a whole nother beast of watch culture. But I think in the Bay Area, there's a few things. One interesting thing is like appreciation for watches almost lives in a vacuum. I think in a lot of other places, appreciation, say like in New York and parts of Western Europe, like an appreciation of watches kind of goes hand in hand with other aspects of the good life, you know, menswear or cameras or cars or things like that. And what's interesting in the Bay Area watch culture is like there's this purity of focus on the watches. And I think, you know, there's a big engineering culture in the Bay Area, obviously. Yeah. And I think watches are appreciated there as a specimen of engineering. There's also a romance of watchmaking, mechanical watchmaking in particular, that I think is really appealing to people who are living in the Bay Area and surrounded by or working in technology. Like it's a nice kind of breather from that world. But yet there also is a degree of technical prowess and engineering and all that in there. So there's this appreciation that's in a vacuum. It's almost much, it's a lot less formal. You know, we talked about like someone could walk into with a pair of sweatpants to a dealer and buy a piece of, buy an amazing watch.
There's a social component to it. And, you know, Gabe talked about the technical, but I think the social is an interesting one too, especially when you look at NorCal and SoCal. You know, one thing about Southern California, and I'm not gonna play armchair. What would be the metaphor?
Armchair quarterback.
Can you say that in regards to having it? Whatever. So I think there's a social element, right? Which is, you know, LA. There is a certain peacocking element.
Yeah.
You know, like I think that like you could easily like, you could see a dude who's wearing really like exceptional tailoring, you know, and he's gonna sport like an absolutely like gorgeous, you know, A series Royal Oak, and like he's totally down for the fact that you're going to see that, you know, and like that's part of his look, that's part of his vibe, you know, and it's a signal.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that judgmentally, like that's just part of the culture, and like nobody's going to be shy about being that way.
Yeah.
In Northern California, a very good friend of ours and a member of Collective often wears hoodies, and if he pulled back the sleeve of his hoodie is a Grubel 4C GMT.
Sweet.
Yeah.
That's a look.
Awesome. Yeah. But the thing is, like, you know, he's a proud collector, an extraordinarily knowledgeable collector. But he doesn't want the world to know that that's something that's on his wrist.
Yeah.
Because he's also like a humble guy. And I think that that's part of the interesting like challenge of marketing to people in NorCal, where, you know, if you're going to bring together, say, a group of watch collectors, you almost have to downplay it a little bit. Mm-hmm. Because if you bring them together with a degree of formality, everybody's going to get uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And right. Mm-hmm. And that's the weird thing, because I can imagine very challenging for watch companies that want to market to that region, you know, because this is a great audience, right? I mean, a lot of these people are younger. A lot of these people are, you know, folks that have the means.
Yep.
But like these are folks that like maybe don't want to like put on a jacket and a tie and go out to a really, really nice dinner because they're going to feel uncomfortable there. Like that's not the culture that they are living in day to day.
Yeah.
LA is different. But I think people like glom it together as like West Coast.
Right.
And like, it's just not. Mm. So, you know, the challenge that I think a lot of people face, and also the opportunity, is like, if somebody's going to buy a piece like an MB&F, let's say, right, where it's like a passion piece, it's like a piece of like kinetic art, you know, it's an incredible watch. They're likely going to want to do that in a much more relaxed setting than they would if they were to buy that in Europe or New York or even LA.
Yeah.
Because that's just the way that they sit in a meeting. That's the way that they have coffee with friends, and that's the way they want to do it. So I do think that as a result, luxury can sometimes read as stilted in NorCal, whereas luxury in SoCal can feel like part of the day-to-day culture.
Yeah.
You know?
Awesome. Well, we're going to have to wrap up here in a second, but I wanted to ask each of you, since we've got two big watch nerds in the room, what are the watches you guys are looking for next? What's next on your hit lists?
Ooh, man. I've been going down. So I love things that are stark and minimalist and have like a real kind of heritage and point of view around them. And so
same page, my friend.
Fliegers have always really appealed to me. And I've yet to find kind of the right Flieger, the one that, and I've dabbled, but one that's really caught my attention is from a German brand, Damasco. Mm-hmm. And what I love about Damasco is they have a very, very German and a very, very modern take on the pilot's watch. So if you look at their Flieger, there's one in particular, it's the DS30. It's unmistakably a Flieger watch, but brought into a very modern context in terms of like their case construction is insane. The upgrades they make to movements to make them more robust are insane. And then the visual design language of it is very Teutonic and very stark and very modern. And so that watch is something I've got my eye on. That might be the next one.
Nice. How about you, Asher?
So, I have been on a real independent bend for a while now, and I'm really enjoying some of these companies and these watchmakers that have, like, they're going down their own path, you know, like, they're clearly making what they want to make. And, you know, a lot of the pieces that I want are well outside of my ability to acquire, but one that I just keep coming back to and I'm really excited about is the Bulgari Ceramic Octafinissimo.
Oh, dude, that watch is so man. Cool.
Yeah, there's so many things so many things about that watch that are badass. You know, like right now, and honestly, like the funny thing is, like we could wax poetic about like, you know, the incredible movement. We could talk about, you know, the fact that that watch is like definitively looking to the future.
Yeah.
But honestly, you want to know what like gets me about it? It's the fact that the clasp is ceramic. Because if you
Right?
Everything's
ceramic.
Is ceramic. Yeah. And if you think about it, you're like, you know, how hard must it have been for them to figure out how to take a material like that and make an actual working part like that be a functional thing that's going to last decades and make it entirely out of ceramic and not take the path that everyone else takes, which is to say, well, we know that that part's hard, so we're going to make it in a material that we trust, but everything else is ceramic.
No joke. We'll leave the watch nameless, but I had a watch in the office just yesterday that was ceramic with a metal buckle. And this was a sample. It had just arrived to the US. It was brand new. Like nobody had worn this watch. And there were already wear marks on the underside of the ceramic bracelet from where the metal was. Just like, I couldn't even tell if it was wear marks or if it was just like grease from the mechanism. But it was like, for a watch at this level, this was a six-figure, really amazing watch. And otherwise, unbelievable watch. But you could just, it's like little things like that would just drive me crazy.
Yeah. And so you look at this piece and you're like, that's, you know what that is? Like, that's a deal.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a gorgeous, gorgeous piece.
Yeah.
So someday.
All right. Cool. Well, thank you guys for coming by. This was fun. And we'll have to do something out west together.
Yeah. Thanks for having us.
Awesome. See you guys soon. This week's episode was recorded at Hodinkee HQ in New York City and was produced and edited by Grayson Korhonen. Please remember to subscribe and rate the show. It really does make a difference for us. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.